followed her to the station with my suitcase in my hand. And I followed her to the station with the suitcase in my hand. Well, it's hard to tell, it's hard to tell. And all your love in vain, all your love in vain. And the train rolled up to the station, and I looked her in the eye. When the train rolled up to the station, and I looked her in the eye. Well, I felt lonesome, I was lonesome, and I could not help but cry. All my love's in vain.
Robert Johnson gets us started this afternoon. Love in Vain, recorded in Dallas, June 20th, 1937. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Our guest today is historian Mary Beth Hamilton, author of In Search of the Blues. In the book, Hamilton tells the stories of the white men and white women who went looking for the music of the Delta. She argues that the Delta blues were really an invention of these folklorists, critics, and record collectors that dates from the late 20th century. Hamilton says it was, in her words, the culmination of a long-standing fascination with uncorrupted black singers, untainted by the city, by commerce, by the sights and sounds of modernity. We'll talk with Hamilton this afternoon about their motivations, how the search affected them, and what the music they collected and preserved contributes to our cultural history. To quote Hamilton again, to excavate the idea of the Delta blues is to describe a history of voices and responses to voices, of the memories and emotions they generate, of how those associations change over time. What emerges from their stories is a genealogy of feeling and sensibility. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guest, Mary Beth Hamilton. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, that number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. W-I-L-L. Mary Beth Hamilton was born in California, now makes her home in London. She teaches American history at Birkbeck College, University of London. The author of When I'm Bad, I'm Better, Mae West, Sex and American Entertainment, she has also written and presented documentary features for BBC Radio. Her book, In Search of the Blues, is published by Basic Books. Again, those phone numbers, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mary Beth Hamilton, welcome. Thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, you're very welcome. So what led you to go looking for the blues?
Well, it was quite a roundabout journey. I actually didn't think I was writing about the Delta blues at all. I thought I was writing about Little Richard. I was beginning a biography of Little Richard and got interested in the fact that he had begun his, he ran away from home at 13 and became a female impersonator in a minstrel show, and was part of what I discovered, a tradition of African-American female impersonation that was quite very camp and openly gay and was very much a mainstream part of rhythm and blues when it was performed live. And I was interested in that, and I was interested in the fact that when he introduced himself on stage in the early 1950s, he introduced himself as Little Richard, King of the Blues and the Queen, too. And I thought about that, and I thought about the fact that he was describing himself as a blues performer, but open any book of blues history and you won't find Little Richard mentioned. And that got me thinking about how the category of blues had been defined and redefined, and by whom. Who was deciding how, what the tradition was made up of, and who was in, and who was out, and what mattered, and what didn't. And that got me started on the path that led to this book.
Yeah. What would you like to say in general about what motivated the white collectors, critics, and folklorists who went looking for the blues, the people you write about in your book. And we can talk about them specifically in some detail as we go on. But in general, is there something you'd like to say about them?
Well, I mean, the people that I look at, all white, they were, most of them were Southerners, but not all. They all came of age in the era of segregation, and they all felt in some way imaginatively tied to the South. And their racial attitudes were a mix, really. But in every case, what they were looking for was a kind of transcendence, a sort of emotional intensity that they found in a certain kind of black singing. They didn't think it was possible to hear in quite the same way in white voices. And that quest is something that goes deep into American culture, at least back to the abolitionist movement and the quest to find the to preserve the songs, the spirituals of the slaves in the wake of the Civil War. So that was really my starting point, was trying to understand that way of feeling and responding and how that intersected with politics and social change over the course of the late 19th and 20th century.
Now, we know of the Lomaxes. Maybe we don't know a lot about them, but we know those names, father and son. But the other people that you write about, how well-known are their stories, and how did you find them?
Well, the other people I write about are Howard Odom, sociologist, Dorothy Scarborough, novelist and folklorist, Frederick Ramsey, also a folklorist and a jazz historian, and a record collector called James McCune. And their stories are, well, each of them, apart from McCune, perhaps, is a well-known figure in a different sphere, not in the context of blues. And I was really interested in people who had gone in search of authentic black voices, but had also made some kind of use of recording technology in order to do so, because that was one of the things that really interested me. That I've said that the quest for uncorrupted black singing goes back to the abolitionist movement, but it really takes on a new intensity in the 20th century with the invention of the phonograph and the commercialization of black singing, the release of what were called from 1920 onward race records, mm-hmm. Recordings of blues and jazz, which were very cheaply manufactured and were distributed by and large in the South, or at least in black neighborhoods. They weren't expected to have a white listenership. And a lot, really from the outset, because those recordings, those phonograph records end up being far more successful than anybody ever expected them to be. From the beginning, the search for authentic black folk music from 1920 onwards is, there's a very sort of vexed relationship with the radio and the phonograph. When John Lomax and Dorothy Scarborough go out looking for what Lomax calls uncontaminated black singing, they're both explicitly looking for voices that haven't encountered the phonograph, that haven't been corrupted by the radio. At the same time, they both use portable phonographs themselves to document voices, because the phonograph is really a sort of double-edged sword. It's an unbeatable tool of authentication. You can go out and track down the beaten path. You can find these hidden voices and record them for posterity. But it's also an agent of corruption. It's a destroyer of authenticity. I mean, Lomax really believes that for black rural Southerners to hear recorded music is to be in some sense corrupted, to lose their kind of natural song-making powers because they're going to be exposed to a kind of factory product instead.
Yeah. Well, how did the act of recording the music change it?
Do you mean commercially or by the folklorist?
In a couple of ways it changes it, doesn't it? Because the race records are seen as contaminated, I guess, if we can use that word.
Mm.
But also the act, when John Lomax or someone goes to ask someone, please, that song that you just performed a moment ago, could you do it for me and I would like to record it, there's something that changes in the performance of it.
Yeah, and that was something that troubled Lomax a lot. I mean, well, there's something that changes, but there's also maybe a way in which the recording machine elicited something that had been there all along. The very first, what we would now call field recordings of African-American music, were made by one of the people I write about, Howard Odom, who would go on to become a very eminent and for the times, quite liberal Southern sociologist. He had a long career at the University of North Carolina. But in 1907 and 1908, he was a graduate student in sociology, and he was living in Mississippi. And he was trying to document black social life. And he wanted to find out what kinds of songs black people were really singing. So he went out with a graphophone, a cylinder phonograph, strapped it to the back of his horse, and went off into the hills outside of Oxford, Mississippi. And one of the things that comes through very clearly in what he wrote in the aftermath of that, because he was made incredibly uncomfortable by what he found, and it was partly that he was a white Southerner who was simply he was raised very poor, and he was not used to crossing the color line, and he had to do this in order to get people to sing into his recording horn, and that made him uncomfortable. But he was particularly uncomfortable at the songs that they sang for him, because I think he was expecting old, time-worn plantation melodies, but he found that the singers were not at all intimidated by his phonograph, that they wanted to announce their names into the phonograph because they fully expected that this machine was going to make them famous, and they wanted to sing the songs that they'd heard from vaudeville shows, from minstrel shows, from traveling tent shows. They were much more sophisticated, much less folky than he had expected. And I think that was something that would go on to trouble pretty much every song collector who went out with a portable phonograph and used this equipment. John Lomax was really quite obsessed by it. The fact that if you bring uncontaminated singers in contact with the machinery, that in some way you're going to spoil them. And Lomax in particular, in his relationship with Lead Belly, was very, very distraught by how that played out.
Yeah. He did a good deal of work with convicts.
Yeah.
And he thought that the convict was an ideal subject because they were literally locked away. But here there are two things that happen. John Lomax is making recordings, which then he takes away. And also he takes Lead Belly to New York. And so how does this square with Lomax's concerns about contamination and authenticity?
Yeah, it is a puzzle. I mean, and that is something that I say in the book. He never says clearly, and it's never clear on reflection why he brings him to New York, because he's said from the outset, he's written it in magazines when he's written about his journey through these penitentiaries, where, I mean, you're exactly right, the explicit aim of taking this recording equipment that he gets from the Library of Congress and traveling through the South and recording the songs of black prisoners is that he's convinced he's going to find there voices that have been untouched by the modern world. And Lead Belly, who's in Angola State Penitentiary in Louisiana, turns out to be this extraordinary informant who can sing every song that he's ever remembered, Lomax believes. Firstly, Leadbelly is released from prison after Lomax takes a recording that he makes pleading for a pardon to the state governor. Lomax takes that recording to Baton Rouge. It's now pretty clear that Leadbelly was released for good behavior. It didn't have anything to do with the recording, but Leadbelly wrote to Lomax and said, "You got me out. I'm going to come and work for you. I'm going to be your man." So they hook up on this initially going through the penitentiaries, where Leadbelly is a kind of demonstration model for the other convicts to help Lomax collect songs. But eventually, I think everyone who Lomax debuts Leadbelly for is blown away by him. And Lomax does have this kind of proselytizing sense that he really does want to counteract what you're hearing over the radio by giving people a sound of what to him is the real thing. So I think it's when he's invited to bring Leadbelly to New York, which is initially, I mean, it's quite a kind of academic context. He's invited to bring him to perform before the Modern Language Association, an academic conference in New York. Lomax has in his mind the idea of doing some good for the cause of folk music by giving people a chance to hear what they couldn't hear on the radio.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I guess I wasn't aware of this in terms of John Lomax's. He saw America as having a rich tradition of song, but scholars at the time thought otherwise.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Here's John Lomax making a great contribution. What was the view held by those scholars, and what led him to see otherwise?
Well, Lomax is a very complicated figure because he got involved in folk music. He got interested in it through studying very briefly at Harvard, where he was studying with, at that point, America's experts, other at least scholarly experts, on folk music traditions. And the belief really was that any folk music that America had, well, first of all, America couldn't have an indigenous folk music of the kind that you found in Europe, because to have that, you had to have an indigenous peasantry. You had to have a tradition that went back to medieval times, to pre-industrial times, and America didn't have that. The closest thing America did have to a folk music tradition was what you would find in the Appalachians, which scholars and folklorists began to dig up in the 19-teens, which were these old British ballads that had survived in mountain communities. So people like Olive Campbell and Cecil Sharp went into the Appalachians and transcribed the songs there. Lomax believed, in contrast to that, that America did have an indigenous folk song community, and that it lay on the social margins. It lay with the outcasts of society. And so he talked about sailors, prostitutes, cowboys, and Negroes, as he would have put it. African Americans had a rich song tradition if you got outside the cities. I mean, that was his conviction. You wouldn't find it if you listened to the radio. You wouldn't find it if you put on Bessie Smith. I mean, he had no time for the things being recorded. But if you got out of the city, if you went down the back roads, if you went into the cotton fields, if you got away from modernity, you could still find these outsider voices. And that was a very rich message. And part of what made it so rich is that it appealed across the political spectrum. And this was the kind of depths of the Great Depression. This was a time when the Communist Party in the United States was getting very interested in folk song and in African American culture. It's a time when the left generally was getting interested in turning to folk song as a kind of proselytizing tool to raise the consciousness of the proletariat. Lomax, John Lomax, was extremely conservative in his politics. He loathed Franklin Roosevelt, even though he eventually would work in one of the New Deal administrations. But he had a very, very firm kind of populist conviction in the untutored artistry of the African-American poor.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest today, historian Mary Beth Hamilton. She is the author of In Search of the Blues. In this book, she tells the stories of the men and women, white men and women, who went looking for the music of the Delta. She argues the Delta blues were really an invention of these folklorists, critics, and record collectors that dates from the late 20th century. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with a question, with a comment. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Well, John Lomax, his concerns are echoes, perhaps, that might be an accurate way or an inaccurate way of looking at it, of some concerns that black intellectuals had. Maybe you would talk with us a little bit about Zora Neale Hurston and her concerns.
Yeah. Hurston was a novelist and folklorist who had, for a time in the 1920s, studied anthropology under the very eminent anthropologist Franz Boas at Columbia. And she was very sympathetic to what John Lomax was doing with Lead Belly. She saw them as kind of kindred spirits. She shared his sense of the native artistry of, as she put it, the Negro farthest down. She was also like John Lomax in having very little tolerance of, and in fact a great deal of apprehensions about the emergence of race records, of blues and jazz on records. When she's in the 1920s beginning her field work in anthropology and goes down to her hometown of Eatonville, Florida, in order to document songs from her native community, she writes to Franz Boas, her supervisor, to say that it's a really good job that I'm going down now to write this stuff down because people are forgetting it. People are telling me that we don't sing anymore. We don't sit outside and sing anymore. We just listen to the phonograph. And she writes to Boas saying that folk music is being blotted out by the phonograph and it's blues. So she shares this apprehension that commercially recorded music is a kind of cancer, a kind of taint, or a kind of infection that's going to spread and that's going to really suffocate a creative spirit that's very important to her to keep alive.
Were there black folklorists other than Hurston? Were there black collectors? Were there black critics who made an effort to record the music that they saw disappearing?
There were. From Thomas Talley in Tennessee at the very early 20th century through John Work as well in Tennessee. And in a way, intellectuals like, or poets and critics like Langston Hughes and Jean Toomer and Sterling Brown, who's someone who I got very interested in the course of the book, who were interested in trying to understand, Langston Hughes and Sterling Brown particularly, were interested in trying to understand not just unrecorded blues, but commercial blues as a form of African-American folk culture. And they were both eager to try to find a way to think about folk music that honored the African-American urban experience as well as the rural one. And I was interested in them as a kind of counterpoint to the story that I was telling, because although there's a brief window in the 1940s when black and white collectors kind of come together, and they come together around New Orleans jazz, and collecting both the old recordings and trying to revive the careers of the singers. That window kind of passes by the time you get to the 1950s and the blues revival that takes off then, which is very much more monoracial, very much more guided by white record collectors who are really interested in kind of defining the blues as something different from jazz, as something that is rural, that is at its most authentic when you hear it outside of the city, and is very different from what, in fact, black people themselves were listening to.
When did people begin using the word blues in reference to music and the term Delta blues?
Well, two different things. I mean, blues was a term that has a very long and kind of murky derivation in all kinds of ways, but it's clearly being used as a marketing term, even on sheet music, before it is attached to recordings. And so that's by, I think, the first copyrighted song with the word blues in the title is like 1912. But at that point, and if you read, I don't know, the reminiscence of the oral history that Alan Lomax does with the jazz composer Jelly Roll Morton in 1938, Morton uses the terms blues and jazz pretty much interchangeably, and it's a sense that kind of floats through that period that in African-American usage, jazz and blues are slight variations on the same thing. It's secular music, music that is not sacred, that's not associated with the church. The idea of something called the Delta blues, that's much later. That's a phrase that you don't see before, I don't think, 1960, maybe 1965.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, yeah. And I think because it comes out at a very particular moment when these old 78s from the 20s and 30s, which have been prized and kind of amassed by small coteries of collectors, begin to be reissued as LPs. And one of the things we're now in the CD and DVD era, so we kind of take the technology for granted, or we've forgotten about what a big change the long-playing album was. But it meant that you could take 12, 13, however many 78s, individual recording tracks that had been made 30 years earlier at different times in different places by different people under different circumstances. You could stick them together on one long-playing disc, and you had yourself a tradition. And that's what begins to happen in the early 1960s, that a group of record collectors that I write about in the book, who called themselves the Blues Mafia and who pivoted around this very reclusive collector called James McCune, they put together a recording, an independent label called Origin Jazz Library, which issued a series of LP compilations of what they initially called country blues and eventually would kind of redub as Delta blues, which became some of the most influential LPs of the blues revival, and really kind of created a sense of this very occult, mysterious, scratchy, strange, primal music that a new generation was hearing in a new way for the first time.
Yeah, it's interesting to think. You think about someone like McCune, and then you back up in time and you look at Dorothy Scarborough. She is coming out of she is the daughter of a Confederate veteran. So we have one kind of period of history and one time and place. And then New York City in the 1960s and the blues mafia in the midst of the civil rights revolution.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, those developments, the blues mafia's kind of culling or amassing of old recordings and the civil rights movement, they happen very much in on non-parallel and non-intersecting paths.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one of the things that McCune, who I should back up and say was a quite a mysterious figure in lots of ways. He lived for 25 years, from about 1940 to 1965, in the Williamsburg branch of the YMCA in a single room. He was a journalist who became a post office worker and then lost his ability to work altogether as he began to drink more, and eventually became a derelict and was murdered in 1971 in a street attack. But he spent his time at the YMCA building up this collection of old blues 78s that he scavenged from junk shops and Salvation Armies and used record stores. And he was, I think he was reacting, he had a very, very refined and aesthetic sense of what he was listening for. He was listening for a particular kind of gravelly, emotive, artful, unearthly voice. And he was explicitly not interested in protest music. And I think here he was very much reacting against the song collectors of the Alan Lomax generation, the radical, the left-wing sort of folk song, proletarian folk song movement of the Popular Front era, which had turned to black music as kind of folk music of the working class. I mean, he had nothing whatsoever to do with that. He had nothing whatsoever to do with the civil rights movement either, which is not to say that he was opposed to it. He was, I mean, I have no sense of what his politics were. The collectors that I've met who circled around him were decent liberal people. I mean, more than liberal, really. But their involvement with black music was not a political one. It was an aesthetic one.
Interesting. Also, I think we should mention that he was gay.
Yeah. Yeah.
And one wonders, you know, there's no way probably of answering that question, but could that have had some influence on how he felt the music or saw the music?
It could have. I don't know. I mean, it was... It's a hard question to answer. He was a closeted gay man living at the YMCA. And there had been, in the 1920s, you know, one of the things that I was eventually that I was going to write about in the book and eventually didn't was this long correspondence in the 1920s between Langston Hughes and the white homosexual music critic Carl Van Vechten. They were very, very close friends, and Hughes' sexuality has always been ambiguous. It's not clear whether he was gay or straight. But the two of them formed a very, very tight bond around the blues recordings of Bessie Smith that they loved listening to, and they would write these letters to each other where they would quote these scatological lyrics from the latest blues recording. And that was, there was a kind of gay cult, that's the wrong word, it sounds ominous, but around Bessie Smith, Ma Rainey, amongst black and white gay men in New York in the 1920s. Now, McCune came very much at the tail end of that. He began to listen, he first heard the blues in the early 1930s. But that's not the music that he's interested in. It's not the music that has a kind of historic gay resonance around it. He fixes on the voices of Charlie Patton in particular, who he hears in 1944 and is completely transfixed by. And I don't know. I mean, it's such a stretch, and the evidence is so scanty about what he he felt. And to what, to, you know, to make any kind of speculation about how his sexuality shaped that is kind of beyond what I think the evidence will sustain. But it's very clear it was, for him, it was a life-changing experience that he describes explicitly in religious terms. I mean, he says that the only way to listen to this is the way you listen to great religious music. You listen silently and you listen in awe.
Mm. Historian Mary Beth Hamilton, our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. She's the author most recently of In Search of the Blues. We have about 10, 12 minutes left in this portion of the program. Listeners, if you've got a question, you can join us with a telephone call, 333-9455. That's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. Well, I mentioned Dorothy Scarborough. She's an interesting character in this story as well. Talk with us just a little bit about her and when her interest in folk song began and what motivated her.
Well, she's a fascinating character. And I was interested in her partly because she was female, which is not that unusual in terms of searching for folk song. It becomes unusual as the 20th century goes on in terms of being involved with a quest for authentic black voices. But Scarborough grew up in on a plantation in Texas and moved to New York City around 1915 and began teaching creative writing at Columbia University. And is living on the edge of Harlem in 1919-1920. And in August of 1920, the first race record, Mamie Smith's Crazy Blues, is released and becomes this extraordinary success. People said that you could hear it playing on any, walk down any black neighborhood in the United States in August or September of 1920, and you would hear Crazy Blues blaring out the window. Well, it's 2 or 3 months after that, Scarborough decides that what she needs to do is go out in search of authentic, genuine Negro folk song. So she sends out a kind of chain letter to friends and acquaintances around the country, particularly in the South, and she makes a number of trips south to gather the songs that she's interested in. But what is most striking about her is that she went looking not primarily amongst black people. She went to elderly white Civil War veterans. She took a recording machine with her, and she got them to perform for her recording machine the songs that she remembered, they remembered from hearing from their mammies, their nursemaids, from the black cooks and field hands that they'd grown up with in the late 19th century South. And it became clear to me that this was not, she wasn't a kind of odd, eccentric one-off in doing this, that this was actually very common before John Lomax, that the number of white folklorists who were interested in African-American music and African-American folklore, but who were not interested in getting it from black people because they didn't think that they would get the songs that they wanted to hear. What Scarborough believed in as authentic black melodies were the songs of the plantation. And that was what she was trying to collect. That was what she was out to revive and resuscitate. And she didn't believe that she would get it from black informants unless they were very old. Or in some way still kind of touched with the spirit of the plantation. And one fantastically interesting thing that I felt when I read her writings is that she actually almost discovers Lead Belly 10 years before John Lomax does. She hears about him because 10 years before Lead Belly was in Angola State Penitentiary, singing his way out by recording a song for the Louisiana state governor. he's in the penitentiary in Texas, and he sings his way out by singing a song for the Texas state governor. And Scarborough's friends with the Texas governor, and he tells her over dinner about this amazing convict he's met who has sang him this song for a pardon. And she's very interested in this, and she records this incident in her book, and she even writes down the lyrics of Leadbelly's song. But she's very content just to hear it from the governor. She's got no interest in going to hear it from Leadbelly. So Leadbelly was actually discovered twice, as it happened.
Very interesting. We're coming down on that time now, and we need to put all this together. One of the ways you describe your book and what you set out to do in Search of the Blues is you say this is really a journey of the imagination. So all the stories that we have now about the birth of the blues, what did they reveal? What did they tell us about how we record our cultural history, how we reimagine it?
Yeah. Well, I suppose, I mean, and this is just a very simple way of expressing this, but what I was interested in is the fact that, you know, and this is not just true about African American music, it's true of any form of music, any experience in life, really. We never come to it, no one ever comes to it purely. We come through it to it through a veneer of associations. We respond to the music, we respond to the quality of music, but we respond to other things too. And I wanted to think about what those other things were. And it does seem as though in American history, for obvious reasons, the issue of race has been so charged and so freighted for, you know, since the 17th century, that it's impossible for the history of the way in which black music has been remembered and documented and archived and circulated not to intersect with other things, other issues, other problems, other politics.
Yeah, well, in music, as in food ways, you know, authenticity is kind of a tricky, kind of a tricky concept.
Yeah. And I think it was, you know, it was important to me to both be critical, or rather questioning, about what we mean when we say that some forms of music are more real than others, what authentic black voices are meant to sound like, and how that changes over time, but also to find some way of, you know, acknowledging that actually listening out for what's real and what is transcendent and moving is not, you know, it's not something to be sneered at. It's something that is part of being human. It's part of responding to any form of art. So it's not something that I'm trying to dismiss or debunk, but I did want to kind of try to climb inside it and understand how that history has played itself out.
Yeah, very interesting. Well, you're going to go back to that biography of Little Richard?
Possibly. We'll see.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon, Mary Beth Hamilton.
Thank you very much for having me.
Historian Mary Beth Hamilton. She was born in California. She now makes her home in London. She's in the States at the moment. She teaches American history at Birkbeck College, University of London. She is also the author of When I'm Bad, I'm Better, Mae West, Sex and American Entertainment. Her new book is In Search of the Blues, and it is published by Basic Books. It's 10 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time. You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. We make way now for Todd Gleason. He's going to bring us up to date on what happened today in Chicago at the Board of Trade and in Kansas City as well. He has settlement prices for us. And then I'll be back with settlement prices from the Mercantile Exchange in Chicago. We'll take a look at the livestock contracts following Todd. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much, Celeste. Thank you very much. Well, you know what?
Well, obviously, we do not want to listen to that. So tell you what we'll do. Why don't we have a little bit of music, and perhaps Todd would like to join us in the studio, in Studio A. He'll leave the Ag office, and he'll talk with us here in Studio A. We don't want to hear that. That's unpleasant,
wow,
isn't it?
That is really bad. We'll have to figure out what that is. There are a couple of things, but how about we just plan on me being in here the rest of the week, and we'll go through the numbers like we are about to right now. Futures in the wheat pit like this. The March contract up 18.5 cents today. $10.96 was the settlement price. The high at 11.26 and three quarters. The low at 10.73 and a quarter. And a settlement price at $10.96, up 18.5 on the day. May futures at 11.37.5 top, bottom at 10.79.5, and a settlement price up 11.05, up 17.5. July contract in the wheat pit for the day, 10.65 the top, the bottom at $10 and a nickel. And a settlement price at 10.47, up 40. September futures a 10.71 top. The bottom at 10.19, settled at 10.59.5, up 48.5, and December contract 39 cents the gain today, 10.82 1/4 for the high, the low at 10.24 3/4. Settlement price for the soft red December contract in Chicago at $10.65, 39 cents higher. Minneapolis spring wheat $16. The final trade for the day down 90 cents, and the March contract down 60 at 14.39. September, the new crop there at $11.44, managed a gain of 19.5 cents today. Corn pit now, March contract, a 564 top, bottom at 540, settlement price at 563, up 14 cents. May futures, 574 1/4 the high, the low at 551 1/4, settlement price at 554 1/2, up 14 1/2, and July futures, 586 1/2 the high, the low at 63, settlement price at 566 3/4, up 14 1/4. September contract, 584 the high, the low at 558, and a settlement price at $5.65. Settlement price in the September contract was 15 cents higher. December futures up 12 3/4 for the new crop, 585 the top, the bottom at 64. Settlement price up 12 3/4. December futures settled $5.67 1/4. March contract 8 3/4 the gain for next year at $5.93. On the high, the low at 557 1/4, settlement price up 8 at 576 1/4 for the March 09 corn, and December 09 corn settled at $5.48 1/2, up 3.5 cents. March oats at 418, up 1 1/2 for the day, and the May futures at 428, up 1 1/4. Soy complex now, March soybean futures, $15.38 the top, the bottom at 63, settlement price at 14.90 1/2, they were down 3.5 cents. May futures at 15.54 3/4 high, low at 14.79. Settlement price at $15.08 1/2, down 2 1/4, and July contract to 15.65 high, low at $14.85. Settlement price $15.19 1/2 a bushel, down 4 cents, or rather down 0.5 cent. August contract in the bean pit, 15.44 the high, the low at 14.73. Settlement price at 14.98. They were down 4 cents for the day. In September futures, a 14.90 top, bottom at 14.25, settlement price at $14.40, down 5 1/4. Now the November contract, 14.34 the high, the low at $13.62. Your new crop November soybeans at $13.91 1/2, settlement price down 7 1/4. January futures at $14.5, we're down 4 1/2. The March down 5 at 14.02. And next year's November, the 2009 crop, that is at $13.31. Finished 7 cents lower. March bean meal futures 380.80 the high, the low at $368 even. Settlement price at 375.80, down 550. May futures at 382, down 520 for the afternoon. And the March contract in the bean oil, a settlement price 65 lower, the high at 69.05, the low at 65.95, a settlement price at 66.55. They were down 0.65 cents for the day, and the May bean oil are down a penny and 0.49, just about a penny and a half, I suppose, at 67.33 on their settlement price. I'll return in just about 11 minutes with the closing mark report this afternoon, when we'll talk with Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services out of Oakland, Illinois, and Kay Whitlock of Terre Haute Grain in Terre Haute, Indiana. I'm Todd Gleason.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from First Midwest Bank, serving the banking needs of Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Mike Morris and McHenry at 815-344-7213. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
Now we'll turn our attention to the livestock contracts and how they fared today, in Chicago at the Mercantile Exchange. March feeder cattle, 101.25, the high, $100.10, the low, the settlement, $100.90, that down 75. April, 104.45, the high, 103.10, the low, 104.30, the settlement, that down 65. May, 108.50, the high, 107.05, the low, 108.17.5, the settlement, that down 80. August, 111.70, the high, 110.40, the low, the settlement, 111.50, that down 60. April, live cattle, 91.35, the high, 90.50, the low, the settlement, 90.60, that down 60. June, 93, even, the high, 92.05, the low, 92.32.5, the settlement, that down 57.5. August, 97, even, the high, 96.40, the low, the settlement, 96.80, that down 10. October, 102.50, the high, 101.95, the low, the settlement, 102.45, that up 7.5. April lean hogs, 57.65, the high, 56.70, the low, 56.77.5, the settlement, that down 7.5. May, 68.40, the high, the low, 67.20, the settlement, 67.42.5, that down 97.5. June, 73.75, the high, 72.60, the low, the final, 72.80, that down 45. And July lean hogs, 76.80, the high, the low, 75.85, the settlement, 76.70, that up 32.5. And finally, March pork bellies, 85.50, the high, 83.80, the low, 85.40, the settlement, that up $2. The Dow is up 11 points at 12,225. The NASDAQ is up 9 points at 2270. And the S&P 500 is up 3 at 1330. The price of oil stands up 4.58 at 104.10. It's 2 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time. You're tuned to WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. Let's take a look at Mike Solo's forecast for Illinois and Indiana. This afternoon, in northern and west central Illinois, mostly cloudy with scattered showers of snow or rain. In central and southern Indiana, partly to mostly cloudy in east central and southern Illinois, and in northern Indiana, look for partly sunny skies early, then increasing cloudiness. Highs ranging from around 30 in northwestern Illinois to 48 in the far south. Tonight, north cloudy with snow showers and lake effect snow. In central sections, mostly cloudy with scattered snow showers and flurries. In the south, partly to mostly cloudy. Lows ranging from 12 in northwestern Illinois to 32 in southern Indiana. The outlook for tomorrow, in northern and central Indiana, mostly cloudy with scattered snow showers. South, partly to mostly cloudy. In northern and central Illinois tomorrow, partly to mostly sunny, with highs ranging from 22 in northwestern Illinois to near 50 in southeastern Indiana. In Champaign-Urbana this afternoon, increasing cloudiness, the high 37. Tonight, mostly cloudy with light snow likely overnight, the low 24. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a chance of flurries early, then becoming partly sunny, the high 35. Coming up, news from National Public Radio in Washington, then Todd Gleason will be in with the closing market report. There'll be more on the weather during the closing market report this afternoon. Coming up later today on The World from PRI, global warming skeptics believe climate change is a hoax and that government should not regulate greenhouse gases. They hold the minority view, but they have powerful friends. Global warming skeptics. That story in the day's news, next time on The World. You can hear the program this afternoon at 3 o'clock here on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. I'm Celeste Quinn. Henry Frayne is our technical director today. The producer for the afternoon magazine is Harriet Williamson. News is next. Stay tuned.